ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Jason DeRosso, and this is The Screen Show. My first guest this week is Russell Crowe. He'll be discussing his role as Nazi war criminal Hermann Göring in the new film Nuremberg.
I will show you a magic trick one day.
What's that?
I am going to escape the hangman's noose.
And how do you plan on doing that?
If I were to tell you, it would not be a trick.
Nuremberg is actually one of two movies that I'm discussing on the show today that I think function as character studies of men with very large egos who end up doing almost anything to secure the acceptance of their peers and, above all, obtain power. Now, I don't want to diminish or in any way minimize some of the 20th century's most depraved crimes against humanity by putting these two very different films in the same boat. There is a huge discrepancy in the level of malice depicted in both. Russell Crowe's film is about the Nuremberg trials. The other movie is about a young man who weasels his way into the inner circle of a famous rap artist. That film is called Lurker, and I'll be speaking to its director, who's one of the producers of the TV show The Bear, later. Now, Nuremberg, by comparison, is of course a film that concerns itself with much weightier issues. And Russell Crowe, as Hermann Göring, is very good in it. He plays the senior Nazi, at one point considered second in command to Hitler, as an overweight, particularly vain man, who recognises that in this trial he's being brought before a team of Allied prosecutors, played by Michael Shannon and Richard E. Grant, who are operating without legal precedents, laying what would become the foundations of international law as they go along. And he believes he can outwit the prosecution. Into the mix, there's Rami Malek, playing young American psychiatrist Douglas Kelly. He's really the protagonist of this film, and he's a psychiatrist who's assigned to Göring and the other Nazi defendants, 22 in all, in order to assess them. And he falls partially under Göring's Middle European charm. Göring, after all, was a cultured fellow. He was an ace fighter pilot, a man's man. And Crowe even plays him with a gentle sense of self-deprecating humour that you could mistake for humility. The Nuremberg trials began in November 1945, 80 years ago, almost to the day. And the war had just ended, so at the time, the full horrors of the Holocaust were not widely understood. And that is why Douglas Kelly might have found Göring an amiable enough fellow to spend time with. Well, in certain moments. But the full depravity of the Nazi regime is revealed in a pivotal scene that changes their relationship. It's a moment that's one of the film's strongest, where writer-director James Vanderbilt, who's best known as a screenwriter, notably of David Fincher's Zodiac, reconstructs the moment inside the courtroom where newsreel footage of the death camps is projected as evidence. And it's a moment that profoundly shocks everyone present in the wood-panelled courtroom. Russell Crowe is very good at playing powerful men, and he's excellent too at incorporating their doubts, their worries, the stress fractures in their facades. It is a pity here that sometimes the movie around him leans on some unimaginative dramatic staging. Nuremberg doesn't reach the heights of the courtroom drama classics, and it spreads itself thin over several main characters, many of whom probably deserve to be the lead in their own movies, including, for example, the American soldier Howie Triest, who was Jewish, German-born, but fought for the United States, the country he migrated to in his teens, fleeing the Nazis. He's played by British actor Leo Woodall, and a bit like Malek, I have to say, gets points for trying, but sometimes lacks the nuance required here. Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer did multi-strand storytelling of this type much better. But I don't want to discourage you from the film, and I especially don't want to discourage you from Crowe's performance, the vanity-flecked charisma of it. In delivering a performance like this, he gives the film license to make its point about evil, and how it's not always easy to recognise. Evil doesn't always come in the guise of a monster. To paraphrase Hannah Arendt, it can be quite banal. Russell Crowe is coming up. And just a heads up, I started rolling on this conversation before we got to talking specifically about the film Nuremberg. So in the first part of the interview, you'll hear us talking about time management.
Let's talk about Hitler.
It is interesting you have not asked me this directly before.
I'm curious what the attraction was. There's a failed painter, not a very good soldier, yet he's worshipped and revered.
He made us feel German again.
How?
First of all, I had seen Germany crushed. And along comes a man who says, we can reclaim our former glory. Would you not follow a man like this?
Depends what else he wanted to do.
You must have great time management skills because of your profession. You can't afford to be late. You've got to be on time on set and, you know, everything's controlled to the second or millisecond, isn't it? It's very structured.
Yeah, so that's my work life is so heavily structured and scheduled that when I'm not working, I don't have a schedule.
Right.
You know, and I sort of prefer to just let things unfold as they do.
And do you enjoy that, or do you crave, after a time of doing that, do you crave getting back to the structure of work on set?
Well, I really respond very well when I know everything that's required of me and when it's required in the days ahead. You know, I've been doing this obviously for a long, long time, and so for sure there is a level of comfort when I'm at work. You know, it's sort of like it's a place I'm very happy to be. But conversely, I'm also extremely happy to be sitting in the bush with nobody calling me by my name.
Yeah.
And just let things wander around for a while. So I think one balances out the other.
Let's talk about this very disturbing character that you play here, and you play him very well. Let's approach this via Douglas Kelly's book, first of all, which I'd never read or even heard about. I think it was out of print for many years. 22 Cells at Nuremberg, I believe it's called.
Yeah, I think it's still out of print. You can only buy it now if you find a shop that's got a new old stock. Yeah, I mean, when you think about the size of the experience he went through, that book is merely just like a notepad, really. So it's sort of unusual. I think something very definitely happened to the psychiatrist Douglas Kelly through the course of this experience, as the film discusses at the end. And I won't sort of spoil it for anybody, but there is a certain very dark poetry to the way he meets his own demise.
Did you come across the book? Did you manage to get your hands on it?
Well, I read Jack L. High's book first, The Nazi and the Psychiatrist. It took me quite a bit of time to find the 22 Cells, but we did end up getting two copies of it. But, you know, Douglas Kelly's not the character I'm playing. I'm playing the other fella.
No, so. Totally. But, I mean, what is important, I think, for the way you play Goering is, I think, the truth that is contained in 22 Cells, as far as I can tell, and certainly from the way that the film deals with this experience, it communicates this. It's this concept about evil that I think preempts what Hannah Arendt wrote later about the Eichmann trial, and she came up with that phrase about the banality of evil. This idea that, and I'm wondering how this fed into your approach to your character, this idea that evil people aren't necessarily monsters that we can kind of, you know, siphon off from normal society and think, well, that's not who we are. There's something of the evil that men do, and they're often men, that is inside of all of us. There's a capacity for that that's inside of all of us, which I think is what the film's talking about. And perhaps it's why you've played Goering in the way you have you?
Well, it was one of Douglas Kelly's disturbing discoveries when he was going, you know, in his first sort of round of meeting the top 22 Nazi leaders who were still left, and that was going to be the first trial. You know, and international law like this had never been tried. They'd never put together a court which was, you know, structured so that the global community could have the feeling that the people that did this were going to be held responsible. So that's the first time in history that that actually happened. What Douglas Kelly came to as a decision was that the by and large, that we're not dealing with madmen, we're dealing with normal men in, you know, sometimes extraordinary situations, but other times in situations of their own creation. And they're making decisions within that bubble. And it wasn't till the war was over that they really felt the weight of the world's opinion and they had to really examine what they'd done. You know, one of the things that I've been talking about with people is how much of a weapon for evil that charm and charisma can be. And it's, you know, it, historically you can find many, many examples, and it still continues to this day. So, you know, you have the objective outside opinion of who someone like Hermann Göring would be and what has been widely reported, and the knowledge that the common knowledge that we all can share from that reporting. And then there's the other Hermann Göring, what actually motivated him as an individual, what his life actually contained, where he got to at certain points for him to make certain decisions, you know. There's a very interesting little fact about Hermann, which to me opens up the great area of understanding. You know, when he was in his late teens, his hobby was climbing mountains. So he's the sort of man who can stand underneath the peaks of the Austrian Alps and make the decision to get to the very top. It takes a certain type of fortitude, egotism, and personal motivation. So I think if you know that about Hermann, then where he got to politically is easier to understand. I think he believed fundamentally that he could control the narrative. And then you see, through the course of world events, him losing that control, then having to sort of come to some other understanding within himself of what he'd been part of. And I don't think he was in full agreeance with everything that was going on. You can see that in the German equivalent of Hansard. I did discover there's, you know, one confrontation between him and Goebbels, where essentially in a public place he's calling Goebbels a moron and questioning the way he has outlined, you know, the way forward for Germany. And I think it's because of public statements like that that life became very dangerous for Hermann around about 1942. And he had to kind of remove himself from the center of things because he no longer had the Führer's trust and his ear. That position had been taken over by Himmler, by Heydrich, by Goebbels. And, you know, I don't think he also had a clear understanding of totally of everything that was going on around him because of his drug use. It's very well documented that at the beginning of the Second World War, there was a reliance on these new synthetic ways of keeping men up longer hours and making them potentially more effective on a battlefield, but also making them potentially far more brutal than they may ordinarily be. And Hermann had a massive habit. You know, he was taking 40 or 50 of these pills a day, and that habit only stopped because he was imprisoned by the Allies and basically made to go cold turkey, which nearly killed him. He had a number of health complications because of that sudden taking off of the drugs. However, once his mind cleared, he became a very formidable opponent because in there somewhere were all the files of the things he'd done and the decisions he'd made. And, you know, his process had started with trying to, in his mind, wrest control of Germany's financial future from the very small percentage of people who controlled the greatest amount of wealth.
Yeah. I mean, he is a person in the film who I think part of the way you play him and the way that the film needs to work is that he has to be quite charming, as you've mentioned. And
well, it's documented. You know, there's so many people, you know, going back, you know, pre-First World War, during the First World War, between the wars, you know, where Hermann is seen as a great guest. You know, he's ebullient and he's knowledgeable and he's clever and he's funny. And, you know, that is, all of these things are part of the arsenal that he brings to the table when he's standing for political office.
But there's a vanity there too, isn't there? There are lots of sort of frailties. Extreme. Tell me about the vanity, because it strikes me that this is a man, and again, going back to the way you play him and the way that the role's been written, there's a lot to be made of his physique and how that physique and him being overweight, frankly, and out of shape affects his mindset. He goes through this, you mentioned cold turkey earlier, but there are sequences in the film that are almost like training sequences from a boxing movie, almost. You know, he's doing push-ups in the cell and all that sort of stuff. Now, where does that come from, and how does his physicality, in terms of, is it just vanity, and how does that physicality and perhaps him not being that comfortable with how he looks or trying to gloss over how out of shape he's gotten, how does that affect his mindset, do you think?
Well, he, you know, like, you know, with the drug use, you know, he was probably not completely clear. And you're talking about a lot of Emperor's New Clothes going on here as well, where, you know, he has such power that the people directly around him, you know, treat him with kid gloves or raise him up onto a platform. I had a choice there because I signed on in 2019. I was playing Roger Ailes in Loudest Voice. The script arrived and I read it, and it was very well realized. So I just said yes straight away before I really considered the danger of playing a character like Hermann Göring. And, you know, those considerations came later and facing the challenge and looking at it and going, oh, I can't do this. But, you know, in a funny way, and I know this is a strange word to use in this context, but that sort of like fear of the challenge is the sort of delicious part of the job where you really don't think you can do something. So you sort of, you know, have to go to quite a deep place. But I had 5 years to think about Hermann, because in the vagaries of independent film, the film kept getting put together, then falling apart and put together again and falling apart. And I made the decision earlier on that even though I knew he had lost a considerable amount of weight by the time he was in the courtroom, the schedule of an independent film is not going to allow me to do some great change during the course of the movie. So I have to choose one side of that or the other. I just wanted to, I wanted people to see him at his, at the height of his pomposity. So I made the choice to sort of stay in place, which, you know, with a 5-year drag before we started shooting became quite problematic. But I'm 26 kilograms less now than I was the last day of shooting on Nuremberg.
Wow, but so that's a lot.
Mm. But I'd already gone up there for Roger Ailes, so I didn't have to do it. But it was the hardest thing was holding it in place and getting about and trying to have a normal life and doing other roles while still knowing that, you know, I had intention in place with Hermann. But yeah, I mean, look, you know, he is a massive egotist. And that thing that I was saying before about him believing he controlled the narrative, I think that's the secret to understanding the things that he did and what he went through. It was very interesting when you expand out everything that actually happened in the court, because we have one day with Michael Shannon talking to Göring on the stand. But in reality, I think he was on that stand for that cross-examination for about 11 days. And there was many different ways that they came at Hermann. But, you know, some of the things, you know, we could just touch on to prove that even though he was taking a lot of drugs, he still, you know, was operating at quite a high level. You know, when they came to him about the art, for example, every single piece of art that he had moved from one major museum or gallery to another, you know, brought in from France to Germany, whatever, there was receipts for.
Or that he'd stolen. He'd also stolen from Jewish families.
But here's the thing. When they started to look into it, and the stuff directly from families is a separate thing. I'm talking about Hermann's predilection to go into major museums and take things out. Mm-hmm. He had records of where everything went. And given that Germany was the occupying force, this was a legal maneuver that he'd done. Anything that was on display in his house, he had a receipt for. Now, yes, in his position as the Reichsmarshal, he's going to be getting a good price. But he still had a receipt for it. There was only one piece of art on the grounds of his house at Curran Hall that he didn't have a receipt for. And the thing is, he'd been brought that as a present from the workers of some other site who'd found it. Oh, this piece of statuary. Goering will like this, so they delivered it to his house. So he was very hard to pin down. And you can see that as you go through the transcripts that the prosecutor played in the movie by Michael Shannon brilliantly. He's a fantastic actor. He found it very difficult to pin Goering down. And the rumors going around in the press corps was that we think that Goering's going to get away with this. And it wasn't until the English prosecutor, played by Richard E. Grant in the movie, stepped forward and actually put the mirror of Herman's egotism right up against his face, and he couldn't make the maneuver he'd have to make to save himself, because, you know, he needed to have believed in the man, Adolf Hitler, in order to do the things that he'd done. So he can't now step back from that belief.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you had some moments where you fretted over playing this character for various reasons. I'd like to tease that out a little bit. I mean, was central to the problematic nature of playing a high-ranking Nazi like this is that, you know, that danger of making him charming in a way that sort of creates an almost anti-hero kind of mythic figure on screen. And you don't want to do that, obviously. I mean, were you worried about presenting him as being too sympathetic?
If you look into him, if you research him, you find that he is not as black and white as you might want him to be. You know, there's a lot of different shades going on with Herman, and that's what I was trying to find with the character, is to try to lean towards explaining why an entire country could put their faith in these people who seem, from our perspective, from an objective perspective, just inherently evil. But you see how things change and how the changes are incremental, and how one decision leads to another decision. And these smaller decisions that people accept in their lives suddenly accumulate into a society that they had no idea they were buying into and that they didn't want to buy into. I think, you know, not sort of like giving people an excuse or whatever, but if you show somebody to be as attractive as he is, it can explain why people might have gone along with something that they found that was morally reprehensible. So that nuance is very important. I think it's very important to the movie, because it's not just as black and white as we might want it to be, at, you know, after all is said and done. And you can see parallels in this film. But like, you know, any great piece of art should do, this film doesn't tell you how to think, but it does actually give you the opportunity to think and consider what parallels you may see yourself. The interesting thing about this film, I think, is if it was released 10 years ago or 20 years ago, it would be extremely relevant. It's relevant today. If it's released 10 years from now, 20 years from now, it's still going to be relevant, because what it's talking to at its heart is human beings, the human condition, and what we do in certain circumstances. There's a great quote at the end of the film that says, if you're looking for what human beings might do in the future, look to what they've already done. Look to what we're capable of. So as far advanced as we have become technologically and in so many areas, we still have this bestial thing at our center where we think a war is some kind of solution to a disagreement. Surely we should have moved on from that by now. We should be far more intelligent than that to understand that the sacrificing of young lives for some political point is simply unacceptable.
Well, and beyond that also, this is a film, I think, that is a moral tale about that temptation to think if we just kind of quashed all the dissident voices or all the uncomfortable voices or the people we perceive to be not like us, things would be perfect. And therein lies the road to complete disaster.
It's the same thing we see people trying to do now, right? Describing to you why somebody else is other. Why somebody else is different, why somebody else is not at the center of your cultural thought. And it's just ridiculous. Any given group of human beings have more in common than they do different. And it doesn't matter where you draw them from. And that is the thing that we always need to come back to and start thinking in terms of, you know, politics and national borders and all these things are so unimportant compared to humanity.
On ABC Radio National, you are listening to The Screen Show. My name is Jason DeRosso, and I am in conversation with Russell Crowe, talking about his new film, Nuremberg, in which He plays Hermann Göring. Tell me, you're really good at playing, I mean, you've had such a vast career, but you're really good at playing powerful men. You're also really good, I think back to something like The Insider, and really great at playing men who actually aren't in a position of great power but have moral choices to make that are difficult for them. But just talking about powerful men, what I like is the way that you can also incorporate into your performances of power these moments of frailty, these chinks in the armor, as it were. What is it that attracts you, or do you think makes you good at playing power?
I don't know. That's a strange question. My dad was a pub manager, you know, and not in any glorious sense. I'm just talking about a local pub that's got a public bar, saloon bar, lounge bar, might serve food, occasionally would have accommodation. You get to see a lot in a pub. You get to see how people interact with each other, and how, you know, on a big night, everybody arrives in nice clothes, and later on you'll see that same woman who was stunning as she came in the door staggering through the car park with her high heels in her hand. So as a young fella, you know, as a young boy growing up in that environment, you sort of see all of the great parts of the community and humanity, but you also see a very concentrated level of the very harsh negatives. I think somewhere in that is all of the dynamics that you're talking about happen within a public house over the course of a week or so. So, and, you know, we moved around a lot. You know, my dad managed pubs in places as different from Camberdown to Double Bay to in the middle of the city. I've seen that same kind of things play out, but in different economic levels, you know. So I think a lot of the things that I bring out in my work has got to do with that, you know, cavalcade of characters that were in part of my life through my young childhood years and my teenage years.
And is that where you get your ability also to play quite fragile characters?
Well, you get to see it all, don't you? You see people at their best and you see them at their very, very worst. So I sort of start to understand that, you know, even that person that might be the most personable and you know, the most popular or whatever, given a certain point of consumption, they too are an asshole.
I mean, and going back to the physicality of Göring here, but also in other roles where, again, I find you, your screen presence is really quite formidable, and it shows an actor, I think, who thinks a lot about bits of business and small things, gestures, gait. I guess every good actor has to think of that. But can you walk me through your process on that? On a film like Gladiator, you know, the sort of moments where just small gestures like smelling something, you know, between your fingers, are they moments that you tend to come up with? Do you like to come up with moments and offer them to directors?
Yeah, I never start a list with, you know, a movie, sorry, with a list that I'm going to check off. I just don't operate like that. I know what the story is. I know what the narrative is. I know what the character is. If it's a real character and there are things available for me to discover, then I go on that journey of discovery. The way I like to put it is that those hours of quiet contemplation are the things that inform you and they give you the full tank, so to speak, of what you can then pass on to the audience. It's a very central thing to understand. The people that talk about, you know, somebody that the camera loves or the camera loves such and such or whatever, that's not true. The camera is an inanimate object and it's your responsibility to feed it. So I always have in mind when I'm working how something might land with an audience, and I want them to know something, but sometimes I'll often hide it from them so they have to do the work to find out what I'm hiding. So, you know, I think I take into account the needs fully of the production and the director and the producer and my other cast members and all of that sort of stuff. But I take into account the needs of the character, but I also include the audience in that equation. So I think some of the things that you're talking towards, because I'm not requiring the camera to come and chase me, I'm actually going to, at a certain point, deliver to the camera all of these smaller pieces of detail and information that I want the audience to land, you know, have land on them or consider. So, you know, this is a methodology, for want of a better expression, that has developed over time. You know, when I did my first movie, or first few movies, I didn't really know anything about what I was pursuing. I had some ideas from what I'd read and you know, being a film fan and knowing what affected me as a member of the audience. But over time, you develop a skill like anybody who's doing the same job for over decade by decade by decade. It's been 40 years since I've started making movies, nearly, you know. So you learn ways to actually get to the center of something a lot quicker than it might have taken you when you were younger. You know, when I did my first drunk scene, for example, I had a drink. You know, I do not require to do that these days. You know, it doesn't, you know, whatever the thing happens to be, you know, you tune your machine to such a degree that you can get to the center of something a lot quicker than you used to. And you know, your nose gets better at smelling the important thing that you just read, not just like, you know, the bulk, like distilling it down to a little bit like poetry, you know. So these things, and you gather these things, that quiet contemplation, the reading, the viewing of things, the discussion with other people if it's relevant, and all of these things add up. So, you know, it's never the same, even though the process is similar, but it's never the same. I don't go in with a predetermined checklist. I go finding what the list should be.
Yeah. I mean, I know I've heard you speak about not being, you're not a theoretical based actor. You seem to be an actor who's learnt doing it. You're not one for theory or sort of that kind of academic approach. But it is
academic in its nature.
Yes.
Because it is, you know, a searching out, that the research period and the quiet contemplation that I'm discussing, that's when the academic in you is required. But once you get onto the set, that's a completely different thing. And now it's time for that performance. So you can't be weighed down by those things. You must be elevated by those things. And that's because you've done the work before you get there.
You know, you also strike me as an actor who, perhaps unlike anyone in your generation, has really had this very smooth and very fruitful transition into middle age. Let's put it that way, where none of us are getting any younger. But you in particular have just found great role after great role. There hasn't been any semblance of you, you know, some actors, you get this feeling that they're trying in vain to kind of keep young or keep to a certain era of their career, and they don't want to get out of that. They don't want to sort of get into the next spectrum of characters at the next age stage. You're not like that. You seem
I started. I started as a 19-year-old being or 20-year-old being asked to play a 65-year-old on stage in a wheelchair. So it's sort of like the game of that, you know, the joy of that, of actually disappearing into the character that you're playing, begins very early with me. You know, my first experience in front of a camera is when I'm 6. You know, and I have some theater experience as a kid and then, you know, other bits and pieces, but never as a child star, always as a child extra. So I'm there on the set, my responsibility is small, but I get to view what everybody else with the larger responsibilities is doing. So it's a long, slow build. So, you know, before I get the opportunity to do a feature film, I've already had 19 years as an apprentice, you know, before that comes up. So the thing is as an actor, I'm interested in fresh ground. I don't want to go out, you know, it would have been very easy for me, and I'm sure you would understand this, to play 20 different variations on Maximus and, you know, have a way more, even more financially comfortable existence by doing so. Personally, that doesn't interest me. I'm always looking for the fresh ground. So, you know, people ask me recently, why would you play, you know, a priest in a horror film? It's like, because it's fresh ground. I haven't done that before, you know, and that character to me, Gabriel Amorth, was fascinating. You know, he's written 12 books. He's the Pope's personal exorcist. I mean, that to me was exciting and fun. And that's the thing. That is the core thing. If there's any one statement to make, I love the job. I love the actual job. You know, I don't love it because of the status it gives me or the money it gives me or all of those things. I love the job of pretend. And therefore, it's easy for me. I'm not trying to be or stay in a place where I'm iconographic to audiences. I don't care about that, you know. I just played that character. You love that character. That's great. Here's another character. And I'm doing, you know, and that's what I do, you know. So the transition from age to age to age is of no bother to me at all, because that's the greatest benefit of the job. It's that there's always a character to play if you're prepared to play your age. Now, I've got friends, male and female, who you know, will insist at the age of 40 or 45 that they should still be playing the dilettante 21-year-old. And that, to me, is stupid. Like, let the kid do that, man. Do the other thing. You know, it's time for you to play the dad. It's time for you to play the grandfather. Get yourself a pipe. Get yourself some slippers. Do that character, you know. But the thing is, I love the job. So it's all joyful to me in that respect. Now, this isn't to say that this job isn't extremely difficult. It doesn't push you to certain places. It doesn't take you mentally to, you know, dangerous places of weariness. Yes, it does. But that pain is all part of the job. And so you have to accept that part of it as the same way that you accept the pleasures of it, because that's cumulatively what the job contains. And I think it's my acceptance and understanding of the job at a very simple level that allows me the flexibility and the fluidity to change from character to character to character. Because, you know, if you're paid to be the grocery delivery boy, you should be a freaking grocery delivery boy. You know, you shouldn't walk on the set and somebody says, oh, there's a movie star, which is the famous Tony Curtis story, right? So, you know, I enjoy that part of it. I enjoy characters that have, you know, whatever effect they might have on the narrative. You know, something like an American Gangster, for example. You know, Denzel's doing this big flashy performance as Frank Lucas. I play this other character who is, you know, just very sure-footed or whatever and moving forward. But there's no flash. There's no, you know, lightning bolts coming off his fingers, you know. But it's just as important to play that guy for the full weight of who he is as it is to play the flashier character for the full weight of who that man is. So, you know, I think it just comes down to I love the gig and I do it from that perspective. And I think people feel that when they're in the cinema.
Russell, it's been great to talk to you. You've been really generous with your time. Thanks so much.
Cheers, man. Have a great day.
Russell Crowe. He's excellent in Nuremberg. The film is in preview screenings this weekend, then releases wide next week. This is The Screen Show, brought to you by ABC Radio National. I'm Jason DeRosso. I mentioned at the top of the show that I'm talking about two movies this week that are character studies of men who seek power and validation by any means possible. And in the second movie, the power and validation is sought in the inner circle of a rising pop star. Lurker is the debut feature written and directed by one of the producers of The Bear, Alex Russell. It's about Matthew, a young man with dreams beyond his dead-end job in a vintage clothing store in LA, who sees his chance of a lifetime when the music star Oliver enters his shop. And by feigning ignorance about who Oliver is, Matthew somehow strikes up a connection that gets him invited backstage. From there, he slowly works his way into the artist's entourage until he becomes a trusted social media and brand advisor, putting quite a few noses out of joint along the way. Lurker is a sharp satire about a desperate but canny individual who will stop at nothing to gain influence and acceptance. It's an old story. There's aspects of this character's ambition in the 1950 classic with Bette Davis and Anne Baxter, All About Eve. There's echoes of this social climbing outsider who infiltrates a group in Fred Skepsy's Six Degrees of Separation. But a recent film I really liked delved into the online fame aspect of this story really well. It was a funny black comedy from Scandinavia called Sick of Myself, about a young woman who becomes famous by deliberately ingesting dangerous levels of an experimental medicine that causes a violent skin reaction, altering her appearance so much she becomes a major news story. Lurker is a moral tale that combines elements of all these films and is pretty good at sustaining an edge-of-your-seat suspense as you watch this young man deceive, double-cross, and charm almost everyone around him. One of the few women in the film, played by Havana Rose Liu, seems to be onto him and is perhaps the only one who tries to call him out. Of course, the question the film eventually asks is, obviously, does this quest for influence, fame, love ever bring true happiness? And given we're on the eve of the introduction of Australia's world first social media ban for children, this film's central question, I think, resonates. There's a late scene in the movie where Oliver and Matthew are at a fan event. I don't think this is a spoiler, but this scene encapsulates the way audiences are so often completely unaware of how the can of beans is made. And they fall time and time again for the mirage of perfection and happiness presented to them by celebrities. Alex Russell is next to tell us more.
So where did he find you at? Meet and greet or something?
No. He came into the store I work at. You make music?
Yeah, sometimes, bro.
You should come to the show tonight. Swallow your
pride. Is this how you envisioned it?
This is the crib.
You should try to make yourself useful. If you want to stick around.
You got a camera. You know how to press record. What the?
You're like my hero, man. You're always on Oliver's Instagram.
Ollie, say hi.
Calling this man Ollie already? You sound like one of his bitches.
You're like my best friend. I mean that.
Yo, get back! Bro!
It's a detail
shot. Walk back. Farm boy, man.
Alex Russell, welcome to the Screen Show.
I'm very happy to be here.
So tell me the germ of this idea and what compelled you to end up. I mean, it must have been a labor of love to get it to the screen, and you've really done a great job as both a thriller and also something I think quite, you know, profoundly critical of our current culture.
For me, there's always a kernel of something of lived experience or something sort of deep down that I'm trying to expose. And it's not necessarily just about society, but of my own participation in that. So I think trying to reveal something, get into the ugly parts of my own, you know, worst impulses and things like that, like the fantasy of that, I think was very appealing to me as a writer and was really fun for me to write. So just being in LA and like, you imagine maybe working in a store like that, like not exactly, but I've worked at a coffee shop and I've been inside a store where I think a lot of people have this idea of how they might act around someone, right? If given the chance. And for Matthew, that's someone like Oliver, but for someone else, it could be a filmmaker or just someone they admire. And the most cutting line in the movie is when someone refers to Matthew as a fan. It's like, no, he wanted to be seen as a peer.
Yeah, as right? a kind he of insider, part of the cohort.
Yeah. I think I can relate to a lot of the characters, but my way in for Matthew was just like, you know, how it feels to be on the outside of any friend group. And I think, especially if you work in entertainment, there's always some circle or some niche or some, you know, exclusivity, some kind of semi-permeable membrane that you're either on the inside or outside of. So that's why I like to say sometimes you're Matthew, sometimes you're Oliver.
Yeah, I really like the aspect of the way that competition enters into Matthew's life once he is in this inner circle. He doesn't like other outsiders breaking through.
Yeah. It's kind of, I've never articulated that way, but you're totally right. Like the person he hates the most is the person most like him, right? It's the person who, by being around, just reminds him of what he's doing and what his plans are. And, you know, have the opportunity to expose that about him.
I mean, the fun thing about the film, though, also is this thread where we glimpse a possibility that Matthew isn't just some kind of, you know, psychopath, that there is something, he has something inside him, which is a talent. Maybe he's got an eye, maybe he's got a sensibility. And so the pretense with which he kind of enters this world to be part of this inner circle that are around this, you know, pop singer, this performer, this creative inner circle, that pretense isn't empty either, which I like because it creates this ambiguity around, well, what we expect from the character, what we think about the character, really.
Totally. I mean, you're saying it better than I could. I think the idea of what talent is or what it's derived from or what taste is or what authenticity is at the heart of what this you know, movies talking about. And I think one way to view Matthew's so-called talents is the ways in which he develops them. Even in that one scene where he's recognized by someone outside of the store, it feels like he's saying for the first time, he's sort of coming up with what it is that he is good at out loud. It's like he hadn't considered it other than as a way to maintain proximity to Oliver.
Yeah. It's interesting how he does become famous. I like the way that the film actually doesn't really go too deep into, you know, some montage where we see all the Instagram reels where he's becoming known to the wider, you know, population. All we see is, because we're really in the bubble with him in a sense, so all we see are these scenes where random people come up to him, usually very young people, and say, "Hey, I know you. You're really famous. I want to be like you." And that's a lovely kind of dissonance moment, I think, where we realize, oh yeah, right, we've been in a bubble with him, but he's in the meantime, in the last sort of 40 minutes of screen time, become really famous.
Well, he's become niche recognizable, I would say.
Yeah.
To the point of, like, you know, these days you don't, fame is almost, it's on a quantified spectrum now, where he can be recognized in a very specific place. Like, if he were to go back into that store that he worked at, maybe there'd be a handful of people who are like, oh, I know that guy. But if he walked into a, you know, pharmacy, no one would recognize him. And I think those kind of strata of fame and proximity to fame is something that is a little more modern.
Have you seen many Matthews in your time?
All the time.
And
all the time.
And have they also?
And we all are.
We all are Matthew. It's so true.
I think, you know, journalists and people in media in particular, I think, deeply understand this movie because there's a boundary of access that you're thinking about at all times, where it's like when you're interviewing someone or, getting a really big interview or being the person in the organization that you work at, where it's up to you or the next person to get this job. Like it's all very sort of unspoken. A lot of the time is the ways in which, you know, people are competing for access or what it would be like if, well, you and I are just meeting, but what if, you know, what if you were meeting your favorite director of all time? You know, how might you prepare for that, right? And Matthew is a prepared person, if nothing else.
Well, I love that in that early scene, in that first scene, it's kind of almost, well, it's your version of a meet cute, and he feigns not being a fan, and that's how he gets in. He has this nonchalance.
Yeah. Oh, I just watched, what's that movie? Notting Hill.
Yeah.
The other day. And it's almost a similar, like, opener, obviously, to a very different movie. But I think he like works at a bookstore and this famous actor comes in. And I think there is some kind of matter of who's
pretending, like, who knows.
A piece of it.
I can't remember that scene very well, but yeah, that's interesting you bring up Notting Hill, because I wanted to ask you about the films that were influencing you when you were writing this, when you're thinking about this film. I mean, I'm thinking, I don't know, Single White Female. I mean, there's a whole heap of films about obsessed individuals that are thrillers or that end badly, or these kind of perverse tales of romantic obsession. And we don't want to say obviously where this film lands, but it lands, I think, in quite an original place, and a place that's quite authentic for the world that it's depicting of fandom and popularity and the entertainment business generally. And you're making quite a comment here on things like talent and quality of work, and, you know, how what we perceive from the outside is so different from how it's lived in the inside. But tell me about those films that were perhaps influential on this.
Yeah, I mean, when I was writing the script, I was thinking a lot about the movie Almost Famous and the movie Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
And I think I was sort of marrying those two two films in my head and applying it to this character, Matthew, that I was building.
So Almost Famous being, you know, film about, kind of based in historical fact, about the Rolling Stone, the young Rolling Stone, precocious kind of music journalist, but also about groupies and groupie culture, and Nightcrawler being with Jake Gyllenhaal being about that videographer who's basically an ambulance chaser.
Yes. And I mean, Nightcrawler in particular, so it's just so relentless and it's so individualistic. And even in the script itself, like you start to see the font change based on how much the story is accelerating. It's pretty cool. But like, those were just two movies I really liked. And I think once I was done with the script and there was some promise of this thing actually getting made, then I went back and watched everything, anything that had to do with Obsession or had to do with, you know, stalker movies or any sort of propulsive thriller. Like, I watched it all. And I think, you know, there are certain tropes true to a lot of them that I wanted to maybe make you expect a little bit and then turn a little bit if I could, you know. Like some of those things are like, I know a lot of people expect this to turn out bloody. Or it's like, you know, what's common in a movie like this is like someone dies. But I don't know. I guess I shouldn't spoil this.
There's a bit of blood. There's a bit of blood, but there's other stuff going on. Well, yeah. I mean, why do you think this film is different? Is it partly the age and, I mean, the historical age we're talking about with social media and those dimensions to this story that make it different? Is it just simply what you wanted to say? Because you are really an insider. You're young, but you're an insider working in the film and TV business at the sort of highest levels. Your name's associated with shows like The Bear, and you know, so you've seen the inside of the entertainment business, and you've seen the inside of the entertainment business where the product is really hot. It's very successful. And that's really the world you're depicting here too.
It's an interesting parallel.
Did you want to bring some of your own experience in a sense of, you know, you thinking about talent and the way the public perceives people being different for the way the people are internally or inside the world?
I don't think my TV experiences hadn't really informed that, because I wrote this movie at the very beginning of my career, and in a way it got me a lot of that work. But I do think it applies. And obviously this movie, you know, takes place in the music world, but you know, Hollywood is is populated by a lot of the same dynamics, I think. And it's also full of storytellers, right? So if this, everyone in my movies is lying most of the time or being fake most of the time. So I would say in Hollywood, it's like, it's worse because everyone is the best storytellers and the best liars in the world.
Well, on that note, Alex, you've made a fun film, which is important to say, out of those quite profound observations and thoughts. Thanks for speaking to me about the film.
Thank you so much. This is great.
Alex Russell, writer, director of Lurker, which I think is pretty on point and one of the better films I've seen recently about the nature of contemporary fame and ambition. The other one I mentioned in the introduction to that interview, just to remind you, was Sick of Myself. Seek that one out as well if you can. Lurker is in cinemas in limited release around the country. That is it for another episode of The Screen Show, carefully crafted and nurtured, as always, by producer Sarah Corbett and ABC Radio National's arts editor, Rhiannon Brown. I'm Jason DeRosso. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.